From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. We're getting our first look at the Biden administration's national strategy to fight the coronavirus pandemic. One of the president's first priorities is to expand testing and vaccine production.
And our next guest applauds the president's plan, but wants to see more done. Dr. Lena Nguyen is a professor of public health at George Washington University and an ER physician. She's on Skype. And Dr. Nguyen, Biden's goal is 100 million vaccine doses in his first 100 days in office. In the Washington Post, you call this a disappointingly low goal. Why?
Well, first of all, I do want to point out that we were yesterday one day into Biden's presidency, and he's already put forth a plan that we've been missing from the Trump administration for a year. And this plan is comprehensive. It addresses so many components that we've all been asking from the Trump administration: testing, PPE, travel, masking. It's very comprehensive. And I couldn't help but think how different things would have been if we had this type of plan in place months ago. The thing is, though, we do need bold action at this point that is befitting of what President Biden calls this wartime effort. 100 million vaccines sounds like a lot, but frankly, 100 million vaccines in 100 days is actually the pace that we're at now. We are at about 900,000, a million vaccinations a day. And so if that's what President Biden calls a dismal failure, then continuing at that pace isn't particularly inspiring. The other thing, too, is at this rate, we're not going to be able to reach herd immunity for a two-dose vaccine until June of 2022. And so a lot more needs to be done. And it's possible that maybe there are supply issues that the new administration is uncovering. But if that's the case, they should tell us and set the expectation, because right now, this is not the kind of aspirational moonshot that we need.
Something else, Biden also signed executive orders requiring masks in federal buildings and on public transit between states. You want to know why he's not issuing a national mask mandate. You also suggested he could withhold federal funds from states that don't require masks. But we've been talking so much about states' rights to make their own decisions. Couldn't a national mandate actually create a huge backlash?
You know, this is a very difficult trade-off that we have to be making at this point about what is an individual liberty versus what is the public good. In this case, I would equate wearing masks similar to what we do with seatbelts and specifically with not allowing drunk driving. This is not about your own right or about a state right. This is also something that affects the entire country. If there is a hot spot in one part of the country, it's going to end up spreading to other parts of the country as well. And so, again, I applaud President Biden's action in issuing this mask mandate that protects federal workers who are in federal buildings. I just think that bolder action would also set the right tone. We also know that what is driving the infection in many parts of the country are indoor gatherings of extended family and friends. It really breaks my heart to see little kids not be in school, but then there are birthday parties and play dates that are occurring. It breaks my heart to see restaurants and retail businesses not be able to open, but people are getting together indoors for dinner parties and game nights. Now, I completely realize that pandemic fatigue is real and that people want to see their loved ones. But I also think that there is a hard truth that we depend on President Biden to convey, which is that if we want for schools and businesses to open, then what are we as individuals willing to give up?
President Biden has predicted that the death toll will top 500,000 next month. But then there is this slight dip in the number of cases recently in some states. How do you interpret these numbers, and what do you expect we'll see in the coming weeks?
I'm not sure at this point that we can understand the recent decrease in hospitalizations and infections as a trend yet. I want to be optimistic, but I'm also concerned because it's possible that we haven't seen the full effects of the holidays just yet. In addition, we have these new variants. The CDC is projecting that the UK variant may well become the dominant variant here in the US by March. And this is a variant that's more contagious. And as a result, it will result in more deaths. And so I am not cautiously optimistic. I'm looking at the next several weeks as some of the most difficult that we will have faced as a country, And things may still deteriorate from there. We need to get vaccines into arms as quickly as we can. And in the meantime, we have to reduce the spread of this virus. And again, I think that's a message that all of us as public health experts, but also as politicians and leaders of the community, need to help to convey, that this battle is far from being over.
That's Dr. Lena Nguyen, professor of public health at George Washington University and an emergency room physician. As always, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, and now to something far less serious. By now, you've likely seen the meme of the week sprinting across social media, that photograph of Senator Bernie Sanders sitting with his arms crossed at the inauguration, looking kind of grumpy, wearing a surgical mask and those now famous crocheted mittens. Our social media expert is here, Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, take it away.
Hello, Peter. Well, immediately that I saw Bernie Sanders sitting there all nice and cozy, it took a hot second for the internet to get going. I thought this has got to be one of the lasting images of the 2021 inauguration. I have seen the senator photoshopped into this season's The Bachelor, sitting there with all the ladies. I've seen him on a bench with Forrest Gump. I've seen him photoshopped with Demi Moore from the movie Ghost. You know that scene with Patrick Swayze? But this time it is the... Yes, lovingly molding clay. The senator with mittens on, that one is golden. So I had a hunch that this was going to be an amazing meme. And my hunch was backed up from data from Google Trends. The top five search memes on Wednesday. Number one, Bernie meme. Number two, Bernie memes. Number five, Bernie Sanders mittens memes. He was by far the most popular meme. And I'm sure we're going to be seeing that meme for years to come, Peter.
You can't open Twitter without seeing it. I'm just randomly scrolling
everywhere.
Down here.
Everywhere.
Here's one from Ben Stiller, Bernie Sanders sitting between his parents on the couch on a scene from Seinfeld. Sanders himself spoke about this with comedian Seth Meyers. Let's hear that.
Yeah, I've seen him.
The other question.
What was really nice, Seth, is the woman who made the mittens lives in Essex Junction, Vermont. She is a school teacher. It's a very, very nice person, and she has been somewhat overwhelmed by the kind of attention that is being shown to her mittens.
Well, that very nice school teacher just got famous overnight, and she's also saying that her mittens are completely sold out. She can't keep them in. Why do you think this has resonated so much with people?
With memes, it's can you relate to them and are they funny? And there's something very relatable about having to sit outside, social distance, wear a mask on a freezing cold January day that everybody gets. It's kind of funny. It's Bernie Sanders. It's a quote from another meme that's really popular. So I think that's the reason why. Let me just wrap up this little chat about Bernie with two comments. One is from his Instagram account and he says, fashion question mark, let's get to work. And also, I want to point out who the photographer was. Brendan Smielowski. You'll find him on Instagram as B. Smielowski, and he needs to get props because that was a great picture.
Yeah, that's a good point. House of Representatives said today that it will send its article of impeachment against former President Trump to the Senate on Monday. But Femi, there is another impeachment fight on Capitol Hill that probably isn't going anywhere. Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia filed articles of impeachment against President Biden just 2 days into his term. Here she is yesterday speaking to far-right political commentator Dinesh D'Souza.
And it's already been demonstrated that we can't trust Joe Biden because he will do anything and everything, abusing the power of the presidency, abusing the American people, all to help his family.
Okay, so maybe a hint of the months and years ahead in Washington. But the reason we're talking about it, Femi, is because Green announced the move on Twitter with the hashtag ImpeachBidenNow, which is now trending because K-pop fans got involved. Tell me more.
Yeah, absolutely. We don't always know where a hashtag history starts, but Representative Green said, let's retweet this impeach Biden now, make it go viral. It did. MAGA supporters were very excited. But if you look deep into why this hashtag is trending, mostly criticism. Most of it is not polite. For instance, True Blue Sea says it's really embarrassing that Marjorie doesn't know how government works. Becky Springer, I wish you would put more time towards COVID relief for the people of Georgia. But the reason why this hashtag took off was because it was hijacked by K-pop fans. I will let Aiden, the destroyer of commies, that's his Twitter handle, explain. He says, warning, hashtag impeach Biden now is trending with K-pop, meaning that if you're a regular person, I implore you not to check it out. It's most likely just a bunch of BTS addicted lefties posting K-pop dances. He's absolutely right. It is full of lovely K-pop singers and dancers, and they are basically illustrating what it means to take a hashtag, hijack it from its original meaning and purpose, and take it over. So if you're an irregular person and you like to see how the internet works, do check out Impeach Biden Now. You won't find much about impeachment of Biden, but you will find lots of K-pop fans and stans.
It would not be the first time that K-pop fans got involved in politics. All right. Femi Ok, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Peter. Take care.
Let's dig a little deeper into President Biden's plan for a sweeping immigration bill that would fundamentally change the lives of 11 million people living in the country without permission. Hamed Ali-Aziz is an immigration reporter for BuzzFeed News. Hamed, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And one of the major headlines here is a path to citizenship for people living in the country illegally now. What do we need to know about that?
Yeah, so the bill allows for undocumented individuals to apply for a temporary legal status. And after 5 years, if these people pass criminal and other background checks, they have the ability to apply for a green card. Those who have DACA or TPS or immigrant farm workers can actually apply for green cards right away under this legislation.
So, and TPS is temporary protected status. That's for migrants who came to this country because maybe there was an earthquake or a hurricane or something in their home country, and many of them have been living here for many years. Immigration hawks certainly aren't going to like this, but I know President Biden has also laid out a plan for more border security. How significant is that, and what exactly is he pushing for there?
The Biden administration wants to focus on technologies at the border to, you know, identify narcotics and contraband. Their focus really is on the technology and boosting funding for that, as opposed to perhaps President Trump, who was focusing on the wall.
Yeah, I'm looking at the outline that the Biden administration has sent out to reporters and made public. It also says this bill will try to address the root cause of migration from Central America. What can you tell us about that? How would it work?
The Biden administration wants to increase funding to these Central American countries, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, about $4 billion over 4 years to help people seeking who come to the U.S. border seeking protection and actually allow people to seek protection to the United States in their own home country. This is a program they think will kind of stem the tide of the larger migration flows to the southern border.
Yeah. What's the reaction been to this so far? I mean, we've already seen a group of Honduran migrants trying to cross into Guatemala, clashing with police this week. They're trying to come north. I mean, do you think that other groups of migrants might hear about this bill and what's going on with the Biden administration and try to make a push to come to the United States?
Yeah, it's always, incredibly difficult to predict flows ahead of time. But I will say that it's notable that the Biden administration, starting a few weeks ago, has said to people to not come to the border. This is not a good time to rush to the U.S. border. They're still going to take some time to figure out how they're going to handle things moving forward. And this has just been reinforced over and over again by Susan Rice, by Jake Sullivan, key people in the Biden administration.
Congress has not passed an immigration bill that's this ambitious in 35 years. So what do you think its chances are of going anywhere in Congress now?
We've already seen Marco Rubio, Tom Cotton, Mitch McConnell, you know, key figures in the Republican Party come out against this bill. That gives you the sense that there's going to be a lot of opposition. It'll be incumbent on President Biden and his allies in the Senate to get those Republicans on board. You know, given recent years, it seems like it will be a significant challenge.
Oh, right. I mean, I'm thinking of historical context here. If you go to that bill that I referenced 35 years ago, 1986, President Reagan signed what is now basically known as an amnesty immigration bill, laid the foundation for much of the anger on the right to this day over the concept of amnesty for people who came to the country illegally. What do you think the backlash would be if Biden and Democrats do get the support they need in Congress? I mean, do you think it just might spur another wave of political opposition?
Even before this bill came into the Senate, the immigration issue was one of the key reasons why former President Trump was able to win his election. So I think regardless of what happens with this bill, it's always going to be an incredibly contentious issue.
Well, it's not just the law he's trying to overhaul. President Biden has already signed a bunch of executive orders, several of them related to immigration policy. One would pause deportations for 100 days. But I know that you've been reporting that the Trump administration was trying to make sure that its immigration policies had some staying power even after Trump left office. How complicated did he make it for the new president?
So in the weeks before President Trump left office, the Department of Homeland Security signed a series of agreements with jurisdictions such as Arizona, Indiana, Louisiana, and Texas, in which the Department of Homeland Security agreed to provide notice of immigration policy changes and allow these jurisdictions 6 months to review and submit comments before the agency moved forward with any of these changes. Obviously, the agency and the leaders under former President Trump were aware that the Biden administration was going to come in and make a series of changes right away. This is, of course, a process aside from the immigration bill. If that bill passes, then these agreements have no effect whatsoever. But these agreements could potentially hamstring the Biden administration moving forward, though legal experts question the legality of the agreement and whether or not they can be enforced in federal court should any of these states sue and say that the department did not consult with them before instituting any changes on immigration policy. You know, we've already seen the Biden administration on its first day make a lot of changes. So it'll be really interesting to see moving forward.
Hamed Ali-Aziz, immigration reporter for BuzzFeed News. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, one of those executive orders seeks to strengthen the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival Program, or DACA. And over the last few years, we've spoken with several recipients of the program, like Graysa Martinez Rosas. She's the executive director of the National Immigrant Youth-Led Network, United We Dream. And she joins us now to talk about President Biden's action, which asks Congress to provide DACA recipients permanent status and a path to citizenship. Welcome back to the show, Graysa.
Thanks for having me, Tanya.
Yes. So I last spoke with you in 2019, and at the time, the U.S. Supreme Court was deciding whether the Trump administration actually had legitimate reasons to end DACA. The court decided it did not, and so the program continued. But what is your reaction to President Biden's action?
I'm taking a moment to take a deep breath in and out and just be present in how important this week has been for all of us. This is a direct result of a Black-led multiracial organizing across the country that made these actions possible and the Biden administration possible. And I think what I'm grounded in is that immigrant young people, the members of United We Dream, we've been fighting to protect our democracy and create a future that includes all of us, including undocumented people. And what we've seen thus far from the Biden administration is a reflection of our power. We've seen the reinstatement of DACA. We've seen a promise to pass permanent protection for 11 million undocumented people. And we're ready to make those promises a reality. And we know that we need to do that within the next 6 months to make sure that we're making it real for people's lives.
You came to the U.S. with your parents and younger sister when you were about 7 years old. And you've been a part of this big fight for years for DACA. How would you describe this journey you've been on? I mean, I'll never forget the last time we spoke. You said your work was a demand for this country to, quote, recognize our humanity.
I've sat with the joy of being able to celebrate and see this day. In the last 4 years, there were moments where I thought that I might not make it. So I just feel I feel like we've accomplished a lot. We rescued our democracy for all of us, and we're not done yet. And so I am feeling really hopeful, joyful, and ready to get to work.
This bill that Biden is proposing would also change the word used to describe undocumented immigrants from alien to non-citizen. How significant is this?
I started my organizing journey because someone called my dad, my family, and I aliens that needed to go back home. And they used other words that are not safe for NPR. But I do believe that it is an important symbol. It's immensely part of our healing journey. And, you know, we need to make it real. I think that we are ready to move beyond proposals and promises and ensuring that we have this Congress pass this legislation that makes change for millions of people's lives. And I'm ready to get to work.
You mentioned the next 6 months is really important. Biden's nominee to lead the Department of Homeland Security is in the midst of his Senate confirmation process. Alejandro Mayorkas would be the first Latino and first immigrant in that post. What expectations do you have for him if he's confirmed?
What we know is that we cannot lead with detention and deportation. The dark legacy of Trump leaves behind is one that has caused so much pain and trauma and deaths of millions of people and their families. And so Mayorkas and the Biden administration must prioritize the safety and healing of immigrant communities and ensuring that we are undoing the worst of Trump's attacks. And so I am ready to continue to fight because this is not a political game for us. Our lives are on the line. And I believe that with the steps that we've taken in the first couple of days and the undeniable power of our people, we'll be able to make these things real in our lives.
Graysa Martinez Rosas is a DACA recipient and executive director of United We Dream. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
President Biden made it official on his first day in office through an executive order to the cancellation of the permit for the Keystone XL pipeline. The order puts a stop to the 1,200-mile pipeline meant to move oil from Canada to the Gulf of Mexico. Environmentalists have contested this for more than a decade. Let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, for more. And Ali, more than 12 years, that's how long this dispute over the Keystone has been going. Remind us of why.
Yeah, so this was a ham-fisted thing right from the beginning. TransCanada Pipeline had proposed this pipeline a long time ago, and they did two things really wrong right in the beginning in 2008. One is they sort of ignored the idea that people's private property is going to be taken for the building of this pipeline, which, you know, you can sort of get away with in Canada. You generally can't get away with in the United States. But the other thing they ignored was the objection of Native Americans to the idea that this pipeline would come close to some of their water supplies and close to some of their land. And look, pipelines do leak. So there, in 2010, Canada approved the pipeline. In 2012, Barack Obama rejected it. He again rejected it in 2015. But as soon as Donald Trump came into office, he overturned those orders and allowed it to go ahead. And now one of the first things Joe Biden has done is he has canceled the permits for the pipeline, citing the risks to the local communities and the climate. And at this point, it looks like this is dead in the water.
Okay, so there was this last-ditch effort, though, to save this project. The company that owns Keystone XL announced last week that it would spend almost $2 billion on solar, wind, and battery power to operate the pipeline and to use union labor. Why didn't that sway Biden's decision to cancel the permit with everything you said in consideration?
Yeah, and in fact, it was an interesting proposal because the union that would have gotten those jobs was a union that supported Joe Biden in the election. So there was some sense from the Canadians that that pressure would work on Biden. It hasn't. And part of that is because Joe Biden's climate proposals are not as big as some of his opponents during his primary and other people in the Democratic Party. So this is a sort of an initial litmus test. Is Joe Biden going to move forward on climate in a way that is completely completely the opposite of what Donald Trump has done in the last few years. And Joe Biden's executive order states, quote, the Keystone XL pipeline disserves the U.S. national interest. So it seems that the decision had been made on this thing, and the efforts by the Canadian pipeline company to do some green stuff and to give union jobs didn't work. It is worth noting there are only really jobs in the laying of this pipeline. Pipelines, once they're up and running, take virtually no labor whatsoever.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So we know that Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and President Biden are actually supposed to speak on the phone today. So what happens next? Can Canada or the company that owns the pipeline actually challenge this decision?
Well, so generally speaking, Canadians are very pleased with the election of Joe Biden. It sort of, puts Canada back in its place as America's, one of America's biggest trading partners and oldest friends. But Joe Biden said that his first foreign phone call is going to Justin Trudeau, and that's today. Justin Trudeau's first comment was, congratulations, Joe Biden, on your election, and we're very, very disappointed about this decision. Remember, Canada is the fourth largest oil exporter in the world. Most of its oil goes from the Alberta oil sands to the United States, and if they can't get it out in pipelines, they have to do it by trains, and that's a big bottleneck.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, as always, thank you.
My pleasure.
Americans are weary. The pandemic, the acknowledgement of racism in this country, and the presidential election have left so many of us aware of the feeling of being collectively traumatized. It's something KSA Lehman has been writing about. He's a professor of English and creative writing at the University of Mississippi and an author of several books that confront and unpack trauma. KSA and I spoke earlier, and I began by asking him some of the reasons he believes we're now having a mainstream conversation about trauma.
I mean, one of the things that's changed is we're using the word a lot on, you know, television. It's a word we see on 24-hour news. We're writing through it. And in my lifetime, I think we've suffered the most trauma that I've ever suffered in a four-year period. And we are acknowledging one of the things that connects us, sadly. And I think Trump and Trumpism made that abundantly clear.
Yeah, we're acknowledging it. So what's the next step? What do we do now that we're acknowledging it? That's the big question.
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure what we do. I have some ideas. I think most of my ideas revolve around like the obliteration of normal, or the obliteration of this desire to get back to normal. I think we have to understand that normal helped create this moment. And this moment is much more than a moment, right? Like, and so one of the things that I want to do is just make sure that like unchecked normal never happens again, right? Like I think this desire to get back to normal is understandable, but I don't know that it's like, you know, the most just thing, the most equitable desire, or the most fair thing. So I think we just have to push ourselves to want to, as much as it, as easy it is to want us to get back to whatever we were before Trump, I think we have to realize that whatever we were before Trump helped create Trumpism and helped create sort of where we are. So that is an acknowledgement. Yeah. And then I think we have to do what some of us have been doing since birth, right? Which is lovingly fighting for radical fairness, holding ourselves accountable, which is the most important thing. And we have to fight faithfully, not just with hope, but faithfully. And I also just think we have to look forward to a future where equity is not just possible, but the new norm, while understanding the parts of the past that we all took part in that led to that norm being something we haven't seen yet. So we have to hold ourselves accountable and the nation.
Yeah. Is that what you're doing on a personal level?
I'm trying to. But, you know, the most important part of that work is acknowledging when we fail. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, I'm very critical of whoever holds that presidency. But I think one of the things that Trump did that is most harmful to me as a person and as an artist, as an educator, is that he modeled a resistance to regret.
A resistance to regret, Lehman explains, is also a resistance to revision, a resistance to saying I was wrong or I made a mistake. Lehman says acknowledging how we played a part in the current state of our country is an important part of healing.
There are lots of lessons in this Trump presidency. There are lots of lessons in this Biden win. There are lots of lessons every single day outside of politics. But I think they have to all be rooted in the desire to look back and to revise what you've done wrong yesterday to yourself and to other people. That's got to be at the root of any sort of movement toward equity that we have.
Mm-hmm. Is it also mourning and acknowledging the feelings of hurt and pain? I'm thinking we heard from some men in particular who say they were so moved to see President Biden crying during his farewell address from Delaware ahead of the inauguration, so much so that they started crying. And it felt like after 4 years, permission to feel. I was struck by that. And I was trying to come into an understanding for myself on why. But I think it's like permission to not hold up this toxic masculinity. What are your thoughts?
Absolutely. When you said that initially, I just thought about Trump again, like modeling what we call toxic masculinity every single day on Twitter and on 24-hour news. And then I thought about the 75 million people who seemingly want that modeled even more, right? But what I think is really important is that it is crucial for us to see, and this goes against a lot of things I believe, like representational politics matters, but I think we have to build the representational politics not around people, but around emotions. And I think we definitely need to see more people in this country who are in positions of power sincerely empathize and feel. And so I just think, yes, like I cried, but, you know, I've been crying these last 4 years. It wasn't new to me. But I do think we all, no matter how old we are, and I actually argue the older you are, and I would say particularly like cisgender men, we need to see more models of mushy masculinity.
Layman recently wrote a piece in Vanity Fair about finding joy in the wreckage. And what he means by that is finding joy in places we least expect. For instance, when he watched the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, as horrified as he was, he also remembered that D.C. was the place his parents first met. It was a slice of joy, a memory that he had neglected by forgetting.
Like my parents weren't together when I was born, for example, right? And I don't think about them ever being together because I could not find that memory, right? When I watched those white men go across that, mostly white men, you know, siege that Capitol, I thought about my parents being together in D.C., right? I never, ever thought about that before. Mm-hmm. Like they were in love at one point. So for me, that wreckage like served as a portal to a memory, to a duo of people who were not in love for a long time, but were in love and were radical and were like, you know, inspired by Malcolm X and were questionable of Martin, but loved Martin just as well. And so for me, it's looking in spaces that we've been told not to look for joy and finding joy, even if it doesn't fit the shape or the sound or the scent that we're used to. And I just think that might sound like whatever, you know, like goofy, but you know what? Like we need more goofy in this country. And that's where I am.
More goofy in this country, right? Yeah.
Yes.
That's powerful. It's really powerful, too. You referenced yourself as an artist, and it made me think about this conversation I recently had with Wendell Pierce, where he talked about the importance of art, how it serves as a reflection in which we look at ourselves, he says, decide what our values are, look at our inadequacies, and then go out and act on them. I'm wondering how you're using art during these times.
That's a great question, Tanya. You know, art is sort of how I breathe, is how I pray. So art for me, particularly like reading and writing, is literally how I've made it through the pandemic. I've tightened up my practice. I used to have a practice that I steadfast to for 20 years. I changed my writing practice during this pandemic. And I am privileged to do that because I have, you know, I don't have to worry about my next meal. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think that what I'm saying is something that is true for every human in this country at all.
Yep. There's also music.
Absolutely. Like, I've been listening to a lot of Aretha Franklin, especially like her rendition of Holy Holy from Marvin Gaye. It reminds me of my grandmother. She still cries when she hears that song. So that's been on repeat. And I've just been like, you know, making my own music. And I don't feel comfortable talking about that because I'm such a terrible musician and terrible singer. But I've been trying to create some songs for myself.
Yeah. And, you know, it's also accessible. I'm thinking about folks who don't think of themselves as artists, but being able to tap into art as a way to express themselves during this traumatic moment in our history, during this time when so many of us are mourning, collectively mourning.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, I just think that collective mourning is what we need to continue to call what we're experiencing. Like, right. And I think we've been experiencing this. Like, my grandmother would argue she doesn't remember when she hasn't been collectively mourning. But I think collective mourning and unity are two different things. And I'm much more interested in what happens if we collectively mourn. Because I think unity or any sort of unification that comes before acknowledgement of all of the colors of collective mourning is not a unification that can hold its weight. So I think the collective mourning definitely needs to precede any sort of talk or movement toward unity.
Kiese Lehmann is a professor of English and creative writing at the University of Mississippi. He's also an author of several books. Thank you so much, Kiese.
Thank you so much, Tanya. I appreciate this.
In one of his first acts in office, President Biden extended the federal eviction moratorium until March 31st. Those eviction bans have kept up to 40 million people in their homes during the economic crisis brought on by the pandemic. And early research shows that they've also helped lower COVID-19 transmission rates. But for smaller landlords like Ayat Nieves, moratoriums don't solve the problem. Nieves is a real estate agent in Buffalo, New York, and owns 7 rental units. We spoke back in July, and he joins me again now. Ayat, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you. In New York, the eviction moratorium has already been extended into May, so President Biden's federal extension doesn't really change much for you personally. But as a matter of principle, why are you against what you call blanket eviction moratoriums?
Blanket moratoriums are incentivizing some tenants who otherwise have the ability to pay not to pay. It's also putting a bandage on the problem. The problem is we need $70 billion, according to Forbes magazine, to pay off all rental arrears. People need help paying rent going forward. And almost half of the landlords in this country are mom-and-pop landlords, and 42% have a mortgage on their property.
So some of the help is coming. President Biden has promised $25 billion for rental relief, and that's in addition to the billions that have already been earmarked for rental assistance by the stimulus package. Will that help your tenants and then by extension help you?
Absolutely. Here in Buffalo, we've applied for the COVID CARES relief, and I've received up to $3,500 in rental arrears, which made most people whole for 2020. But now in 2021, half of my properties haven't paid their rent. Some are applying for additional relief. Other tenants simply refuse to answer our calls or make a good faith payment.
Wow, half of your tenants haven't paid their rent? Tell me more about that.
So on one case, a tenant claimed that she had coronavirus and she had to quarantine. So I helped her navigate the website, which is through the 211 system, and apply. But she told me she's had a lot of problems and poor quality internet. Another tenant was recently approved for December and January payment, but I'm concerned if she can pay February and going forward. A third tenant forgot to recertify his paperwork, so his rental assistance was cut off for January and February. And if he doesn't turn his paperwork in, I won't get paid for March or the foreseeable future. It's been pretty tough.
Yeah, it sounds like it. We see that across the country, 28% of renters began the new year with an unpaid rent bill, and that's according to the company Apartment List. So for you, it's actually worse than that. What does that mean financially for you? How much pressure does that put on you and your business?
It's very difficult. As a realtor, we shut down in New York State. I was a non-essential worker, so I didn't work for 2 months. So my income as a realtor has been cut in half. And the rental properties provide me supplemental income, but they also take a lot of work. For example, the one unit that's not paying me, I invested over $12,000 last year, and I still haven't recouped that, and now I'm not making money.
This is so complicated because, obviously, we hear you and we feel your pain. On the other hand, you know, you were telling us a story about one of your tenants who got sick with COVID and can't pay. So what's the solution here? What would make everything better for both you and for the people who are in your buildings?
The government needs to pay off the $70 billion needed to pay off all rental arrears. And for some tenants who, you know, are over that threshold, they should provide zero interest loans. They should also make loans more readily available to landlords and tenants. And then they should expand the Section 8 voucher housing voucher program nationwide. Currently, there are 3 million families on the waiting list. And if they didn't close the list, there'd be over 9 million families.
Do you think at any point in this crisis, it is appropriate to evict people?
Absolutely. Here in Buffalo, we've had several instances in which tenants are engaged in illegal behavior. In one such example, the tenant had a dispute with the lower tenant and they shot up the house. So those tenants should be removed immediately. And others doing illegal activity should be as well.
The last time we spoke, you had mentioned that the housing market in Buffalo was really, really picking up in July because people were looking to buy homes outside of New York City, leave the big expensive city and go to someplace cheaper. How are things today? I mean, it's amazing in this crisis that we're in that the housing market is still as strong as it is. And I just wonder how that affects your rental business.
The housing market's doing great. Demand is up and supply is low. And, you know, we put in a lot of offers with first-time home buyers, and we're getting outbid 20, 30, 40,000, sometimes more. This one house we put an offer in on, there were 36 offers in total.
So with the housing market so hot in Buffalo and with your rental business suffering as much as it is, are you tempted to sell, to get out of it?
Absolutely. We've considered it, and a lot of my landlord associates are actually doing the same. I have a landlord. He's got 20 units. 10 are vacant by choice. The 10 that are occupied, only half are paying. We're currently liquidating his portfolio one by one.
The challenge here is that affordability just becomes out of reach for so many people. Ayat Nieves, a landlord and a real estate agent in Buffalo, New York, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.